Welcome to This Is Money podcast. I'm Georgie Frost, and joining me and Deputy Editor Helen Crane today is Pensions and Investments Editor Tanya Jeffries. And coming up, aged 43 to 54, bad luck. You may have to work longer as rumours abound over whether the state pension age will be hiked to 68 in 2035. Where has all this come from, though? And is it likely? Santander and Barclays become the latest major mortgage lenders to slash rates. Will we see them back below 4% this year? And with rates having risen again, are premium bonds now the best place for your rainy day savings? Also today, we have the good, the bad, and the downright disgraceful. Helen gives us the lowdown on which companies are doing right by their customers and which most certainly are not. Plus, how to spot bargains in charity shops, haggle down prices at car boot sales, and then make money selling things on. Don't forget to stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app.
Market updates and conversations around the financial world don't have to be boring. The Digest and Invest podcast by eToro is a great way to tune into what's happening in a fun and easily digestible format. Discover the Digest and Invest podcast at eToro.com/academy/podcasts.
But first, there are rumours that the planned rise to the state pension age is going to be sped up. Officially, the rise to 68 is set to happen between 2044 and 2046. However, a previous government review recommended it should be brought forward to 2037 to 2039. Are you keeping up? The rumours now suggest it could happen as early as 2035, meaning those aged roughly between 43 and 54 would face working for longer. Now, there's been some outcry, warnings that ill and poor people and carers will bear the brunt of the hike. Younger generations too are likely to struggle. So, Tanya, our pensions and investments editor, are the rumours true? But first, what are the current plans with the state pension age? When is it going up to 67, 68? What is it now? Why are they thinking of raising it at all?
It's 66 at the moment for both men and women. It's going up to 67 between 26 and 28. It goes up gradually depending on which month you were born. The big controversy is when will the move to 68 be? I think the best way of describing what the government's been doing over the past few years about this rather difficult decision is it's been dithering, frankly. In legislation, it's supposed to be 44 to 46, which is quite some time away, but it's on its second review. The answer it got from the first review was bring it forward to 37 to 39. And they said, okay, sat on it for a while, decided they'd have another review. So they gave themselves plenty of time to do this second review, but it has got to be, by law, I believe, published this spring, and the obvious time to do it would be to announce it alongside the budget, which is March the 15th. And it's difficult to know how true this rumour is and what exactly might happen. My suspicion is that this is kite flying. They know it's going to be controversial. Mm-hmm. They've leaked it out to see how ferocious the reaction is going to be. Pretty much anything that makes the state pension worse for people is automatically controversial. And this is no different. It's fighting on a different front, maybe, but it boils down to the same thing, which is older voters vote and they do not like the state pension being messed with.
So needless to say, it's not gone down well. So likely not to happen.
I wouldn't say that. It depends why you think they're doing it. I mean, there are definitely some good reasons to look at the state pension age, apart from the obvious, which is they do need to raise some money one way or another. And this would definitely save them some money. They could redo all their projections, basically, if they weren't spending so much money on the state pension. But there's also life expectancy. And this is a tricky one. They do try to keep a certain proportion of the population working as a ratio to the amount of people who are in retirement, which is fair enough. And in recent decades, life expectancy has been rising. So it's quite easy to see why the trajectory of state pension age reviews is always upward. But it has stalled, and it's difficult to know how much of that is down to the pandemic. As I recall, there was already talk about the pace slowing even before the pandemic, but certainly that's really caused a glitch. So they're going to bear all that in mind, obviously. But when it comes to the money raising side, you've got to look at where else they might drum up some cash. If you're just looking at the pension side of it, we've talked about pension tax relief in the past. That could bring in a lot of money, but it is very, very complicated. And governments tend to have a look at it, then back off very slowly. And obviously, the other thing is the state pension triple lock. I mean, they bit the bullet this year. They've given everyone a hefty 10% rise. They may be hoping that inflation is down by the autumn, that wages are not too high, and they'll be able to get away with a more modest triple lock increase. But if they can't, then we're going to have yet another big fight over the triple lock. And so they may be weighing up whether a state pension age increase might be a better plan. But obviously, those are more political considerations.
Before we leave this, Tanya, give us some tips, some pension savings. What should we be doing right now, apart from panicking that we're all going to work longer and feeling miserable about it? I don't mind.
Yeah. Well, this is one of the things you see. A lot of people like working and they don't really mind. A lot of people like working, but they are doing jobs that involve physical activity, which they are not necessarily going to be able to do till 68. So they're going to have to find something else to do. Or this is the big warning from Age UK, really, is that people who are forced into caring, people who lose their jobs and can't get another one, people who physically just can't work anymore because of the nature of the work they've done before, they're likely to suffer most, plus younger generations, obviously, who are not going to benefit as much from the state pension as older generations. I think this is something to be aware of if you're in your mid to late 40s and upwards. It may not affect you, but it might. If you think that you're not going to be able to do your job until you're 68, I have a relative who's a teacher, for instance. Now, that's a job she loves, but does she want to be standing in front of classrooms at 68 on her feet, or does she need to start thinking about doing something else? Obviously, there's the usual advice about saving harder. If you think you're going to have to plug a gap between, you know, you think, well, I'm going to try and retire at 62 and there's going to be a longer gap until state pension age kicks in, look at ISAs and definitely look at putting more into your private pensions. There is one more thing to note about pension ages, which I think we need to say every single time we talk about pension ages, we need to throw in that the age when you can start drawing on your private pensions is going to go up from 55, which it's been at for quite a long time, to 57 in 2028. So that is something to factor in as well.
So that's potentially the bad news, but it's not all been bad news in the world of finance. Santander and Barclays became the latest lenders to reduce their mortgage rates following similar moves from Halifax, Nationwide and the Mortgage Lender last week. Okay, so it wasn't a huge amount. I mean, up to 0.2% for Santander, 0.27% for Barclays, but it's a movement in the right direction. So will we get back to sub 4% this year? Helen, goodness me, it was only, just over a year ago, we were talking about sub 1%. But I suppose, yeah, every little helps at the moment.
Sure. I mean, I do feel really sorry for people who have had to remortgage or who are buying a new home in the last few months, because mortgage rates have been so up and down. As you said, so back in mid-2021, we were looking at rates below 1%, historic lows, cheapest mortgages have ever been. They've been creeping up since about the start of last year. So when the base rate started going up, mortgage rates kind of went up in line with that, but in quite a, you know, sort of gradual way. The mini budget, which is something we keep coming back to on this podcast, but it was so momentous in a bad way, not momentous in a good way, generally. So that's that mortgage rates really rocketing. So October last year, the averages were hitting about 6.5%, which is higher than we've seen mortgage rates for years. And that is an average, you know, some people were paying less. But what we've seen in the last couple of months is rates starting to come down. And that's kind of accelerated in the last couple of weeks. So big banks, Santander, Barclays, Halifax, Nationwide, they've all brought their rates down a bit. You know, these aren't huge cuts. You know, mortgage rates never, you know, they do move generally in little sort of increments. So Santander's put rates down by up to 0.2% across most of its range. The other big lenders I just mentioned have kind of made similar moves, which is the boon for borrowers. You know, everyone likes their mortgage rate to go down. The averages we're looking at now, about 5.5%, but these specific deals, these are on the slightly cheaper than that. So Barclays product with a 25% deposit is now at 4.41%. That's a decent reduction. That's kind of taking things back to the level we were seeing before the mini budget. So it's essentially that madness has been kind of erased from the mortgage market now, which is good news. So on that Barclays rate I just mentioned, if you had a £200,000 mortgage on a 25-year term, that will have cut you £31 a month compared to what the rate was before this cut. So, you know, it's not huge savings, but it's decent. I think the issue is, and something I'm kind of worried about, is we've got another base rate decision next week. When the base rate goes up, lenders tend to kind of respond in kind and they put their mortgage rates up. So I'm kind of wondering, are these lenders making little cuts now to get some customers in, knowing that they're probably going to hike their rates up again next week? That might be a bit cynical of me, but it does seem a bit more than a coincidence that all the big lenders have kind of decided to do this the week before the mini budget. I mean, it's all kind of supply and demand. So they know that they cut rates, they get more borrowers in, then they put them up, they get less borrowers. It's all kind of quite complicated financial mechanisms based on how many mortgages they can kind of service at any one time. But yeah, in short, for now, mortgages tend to be sort of moving in the right direction, which is good.
Are these the best that you can find at the moment, the big banks, or is this somewhere else to go? Where do you find the best rates?
Yeah, with mortgages, so it does tend to be the big banks that are the most competitive. So I think the very lowest rate on the market at the moment is from Halifax. That's 4.04%, but that is on a 10-year fix. So banks at the moment tend to be wanting people to lock into their mortgages for longer, because in the long term, mortgage rates probably are going to go down. So if they lock someone in at 4% today, in a year or so, the bank's making quite a bit of money on that. So yeah, it tends to be fixing for longer, will get you a cheaper rate. But is that a good idea? I mean, it really is up to borrowers to make a call at the moment. It's not that easy to simply say, you know, in a couple of years, the base rate will be X. So next week, the base rate is currently 3.75%. It's tipped to go up to 4% next week. But then opinions on what happens after that are kind of varying at the minute. Some people are saying it'll go up again after that, but then by the end of 2023, it'll be back down below 4% again, which would make taking a 5% fix today not necessarily look a good deal. Other people think the impact of inflation will go on for longer. So it's a tricky call to make. I mean, a lot of people at the moment seem to be going for 5-year fixes on these kind of rates, because I think people just like the certainty of, you know, they might be paying a bit more, but at least they can plan and they know where they're going. I mean, other people are going completely the other way and going for trackers, saying, you know, trackers obviously kind of follow the base rate plus a certain percentage. But the good thing with trackers is you can, it's much easier to exit the mortgage and change to a different deal. So that's people kind of hedging their bets, saying, go on to a tracker for a little while, see how things play out, and then I'll perhaps fix in a few months when it's clearer what direction rates are going in. I mean, yeah, as I said, I don't envy people having to get a new mortgage at the moment at all, because it is really tricky to see where things are going. And of course, the other thing that people need to bear in mind is house prices seem to be going down. So that's another whole thing that people need to be concerned about. It's tricky time, but at least rates seem to be going down for now, which is, you know, it's a little positive.
Tanya, what do you reckon? Tracker, fix, 10-year fix?
You just have to make an educated guess, don't you? I think you make a decision partly based on the best guess you can make as to where interest rates are going to go and then mortgage rates are going to go. But also, you've got to feel comfortable with it. If you really want the certainty for 5 years or even 10 years, and I think we've talked on this podcast before, if you've moved to your forever home and you just want certainty, then maybe you're more inclined to go for 10 years. Personally, I feel more comfortable at a 2-year level, just because I don't like the uncertainty of not knowing what might happen and I might lose out. There's a big dose of loss aversion, I think, when you're making these kind of decisions. And when I'm talking about comfort levels, I would really, really hate to get stuck on something for a really long time that was where I was really losing out. I have actually got to remortgage in the next few months, so I'll come back and tell you how it went. My approach is to start with what is my current lender offering. You don't really want to get involved in a load of admin for an extra £2 a month off your mortgage necessarily. Obviously, for some people, every pound will count. But my approach is to see what my current lender will do first and then branch out from there.
All right, then. So continuing with the better news, should we call it? Premium Bond Savers are set for even better payouts after NS&I raised its prize fund to 3.15%, starting from its draw next week. That's the fourth rise in a little over a year. So is this the best home for your money? Tanya, fourth rise in a little over a year. What's going on at NS&I?
It's really gone up an awful lot. At the beginning of 22, it was 1%. Obviously, it's to do with interest rate rises. And I suppose they're trying to stay competitive with other savings rates. It does put it in quite a good place in the rankings. So I think if you're asking, is this a good place for your money? It's definitely worth a good think about it. Now, our editor, Simon Lambert, has written an opinion piece about this week, and he is actually moving his rainy day fund to this. He warns, though, that you've got to think about two things in particular. One is the instant access good enough for you? It's going to take a couple of days, potentially, to get your money out. So how instant do you need your access? And also to bear in mind that this new rate of 3.15 from beginning of next month is not certain. That it's all based on luck. I mean, how many times are you going to win? You might do much less than that. You might do a lot better. I mean, you could be the big winner. You could have Agent Million coming around. So that really is down to whether you're a gambling person, I guess, to some extent. But it does stack up well. I think it's worth looking at the other accounts that NS&I offer generally. They're also going up. Their direct saver is going up from 2.3 to 2.6. Their ISA is going up from 1.75 to 2.15. And they've got a income bond one, which also is going up to 2.6. So not as good as the rate you get if you had the average amount of luck. The other ones that Simon highlighted in his article, Yorkshire Building Society, they've got a 3.35 rainy day account, but it's got quite a lot of restrictions on it, really. You only get that on the first 5,000 and then it goes down to 2.85. And also it's not a very instant access option. There's 2 days of the year you can make withdrawals on the anniversary of taking out and when you close it. The option down from that is Shawbrook Bank, 2.92. So that is the lay of the land at the moment. And I guess it is down to personal choice. Some people love premium bonds and will be absolutely delighted that they're getting a great deal on it. And others just want to be in premium bonds anyway.
Helen, love premium bonds?
As Tanya said, these are decent rates and they're coming up to a level where they sort of stack up better against other savings providers. Honestly, not for me. I think it kind of depends what you're doing with your savings. So I'm saving for a house deposit. And personally, I just like to know most of my money is in a fairly well-paying, easy access account. I do have a few pots elsewhere. But I just think for me, knowing that I'll probably need to draw on my savings in the next couple of years, I'd prefer to just get my boring old, I think it's about £40 a month I get in interest on my savings, but it comes in every month. I know I'm always going to get it. I think it's like Tanya was saying with their mortgage, sometimes you just like to know what you're getting. But, you know, later on, if I had a savings pot that wasn't necessarily tied to a specific kind of end, yeah, maybe I'd, you know, have a roll on the premium bonds dice. But I don't know, maybe I'm just a boring person, but I just prefer to know where I'm at with my savings. But I know clearly, you know, premium bonds are the most popular savings product in the UK. So clearly many, many people disagree with me.
Not boring, sensible. And that's absolutely fine. And that's it for part one.
I'm joined now by Sam North of eToro for our weekly update on the markets. Sam, what's been happening over the past week?
Yeah, well, it's been a pretty good week for investors all in all. There's been a few times this week where the sellers have taken over and started to, I imagine, to get pretty excited early on in the day, only to be kind of put back in their place by the buyers as they bought the dip. I mean, we're currently, as it stands, near some very important technical levels in the main US equities, which sets us up really well for what is a mammoth of a week coming up. In what was probably the main data point of the week, we had US GDP, which did show some signs to resilience of a recession fear, but also enough of a slowdown to keep investors happy that inflation will continue to fall. On the earnings front, Tesla's share price moved higher by double digits. Microsoft also has been pushing on to the back end of the week. So Elon Musk will be happy about Tesla for sure. And in general, earnings have actually fared okay.
And what do we have to look forward to next week?
Yeah, next week's big, really big. We've got some real important macro events and some key earnings from some of the biggest US companies too. In the US, the number one event is going to be the next interest rate decision by the Federal Reserve. As weeks have gone by and led up to this event next Wednesday, it's been pretty much nailed on and priced in that they're going to raise interest rates by 25 basis points. So that is expected, it's priced in. So it's really going to come down to the press conference from Jerome Powell. So any forward guidance from the chair of the Fed there, we were keeping an eye on. The market's had a good start to the year, so you probably won't want it to get too carried away. That's what I'd be looking out for. Elsewhere in the US, we have the latest jobs numbers, which come next Friday. So if we're sitting here in 7 days' time and the markets are still up, it'd be a big win for bullish investors. Also had the Bank of England interest rate and the ECB, as well as both of their latest GDP figures. And in the EU, you also have the latest inflation number, which just completes a massive macro week. And then the earnings, some of the companies, which I'm sure many people will have heard of, ExxonMobil, McDonald's, Meta, Alibaba, Apple, Alphabet, and Amazon. A simply massive week in financial markets.
Sam North from eToro, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Welcome back. Now, you might remember our old friend Lee, once of this parish, Lee Boyce, joined us for a cameo not too long ago to tell us about Money Mail's annual Wooden Spoon Award for poor customer service. Now, Lee, ever the professional, if you remember, he sat on the fence. He wouldn't commit to picking his winner or loser, whichever way you want to look at it. I, however, was unequivocal when it came to mine. The victor has finally been revealed. And what a deserved win it was for British Gas. Yes, my Bete Noire of 2022 took a massive one-third of the total vote. Now, I'm confident that mentioning it on the pod didn't affect voting behaviour of our good readers and listeners, but tough if it did, it's still well-deserved. Shortly, because we do like to look at the bright side, look on the bright side of life on this pod, we will reveal the customer service champions. But let's go with British Gas first. I'm not going to go over why I have a particular issue with British Gas. Listen to podcasts past. But I will give a very brief summary that it involved Tanya debt collectors, threatening letters, 10 months and 20 plus hours of phone calls, tears, Tanya, tears.
Tears.
Sweat, blood. Anyway, so thankfully it was rectified. I think they sent a letter of correction to the credit reference agencies. I said in lieu of compensation, I would like them to make a hefty donation to an energy charity. I've yet to hear anything about that. I got some colleagues on a newspaper to try and chase that one up. They also have not heard, but be that as it may. Tanya, it's not all about me. It's about British Gas being useless and everybody else thinking that. So tell me, why did they win? And so spectacularly as well.
Yes, really spectacularly. I'm so sorry to hear all about that, Georgie. It sounds an absolute nightmare, and you're clearly not alone. So a hefty proportion of people voted for British Gas. There were three reasons. Long wait times when you're trying to get things fixed. I mean, yours took 10 months, so I'm sure you can sympathise with that. Wrong bills and government support vouchers. People really struggling to get government support vouchers out of British Gas. I think it added insult to injury that the boss wouldn't show up Money Mail helpfully tell us that he's reportedly on £875,000 a year, not including bonuses, et cetera, et cetera. So yes, that's British Gas. I'm not with British Gas, so I can't speak personally to this. Helen, are you with British Gas?
I'm not, but I will say that I run This Is Money's consumer champion column, Crane on the Case, and I get a lot of emails from readers about different companies. And I will say I've noticed British Gas is one of the worst offenders in my inbox as well. And actually, energy companies generally, it really didn't surprise me that the winner of the wooden spoon was an energy company. I think what's really annoyed people in the last year or so, of course, bills have been going up massively. We all know this and cause real hardship for a lot of people. Some of that isn't the energy company's fault. Some of it is. But I think what they could at least do is to give their customers proper service. You know, people are paying absolute whack for their energy bills. And I think it really sticks in the craw when companies can't even sort out a problem efficiently when you have one, you know. These companies are making massive profits out of the energy crisis. You know, they can afford to hire more people in their customer service centres. Of course they can. And I think what really has annoyed our readers is that they haven't used that money to make sure that they can sort out problems that people have quickly and efficiently. They haven't used it to make sure they can pay people the support vouchers that they're entitled to. And I just think it just smacks of sort of laziness and indifference, really. And yeah, we report on these companies' profits all the time, and they're massive. And I think customers just find it really offensive, to be honest.
I keep hearing that it's the COVID excuse. We are so beyond that now. Is it just me, or has customer service just got so much worse? And this is not a criticism of those people that work in customer service. This is a criticism about the amount of resources that are going to customer service. I'm wondering, is it just because companies keep putting it on, I don't know, Twitter complaints, Helen, or some sort of chat bot thing, rather than actually having real people on the end of a telephone line? Or is this just me getting grumpy old woman? But having moved flat recently, I'm not with British Gas anymore, and having to deal with the Skies, all of the utility companies, I have never, and estate agents and all sorts of things, I've never experienced anything worse. At every single level of my move, there was a problem. I want to repeat again, it is not the people on the end of the phone, they do a good job. It is the resource being put there. But Helen, is this just because I'm getting grumpy in my old age, or actually are things substantially worse?
I understand why people think it's getting worse. You're right, a lot of the companies are still using the COVID excuse, saying, you know, we had to let staff go during COVID, and you know, I think a lot of companies possibly haven't kind of hired them back and use that as a bit of a kind of cost-cutting exercise. But again, these companies make a lot of money. They can afford to hire more people, and they don't. I completely think that customer service has got worse in my own experience as well. I think you're right to point out the kind of social media thing. Companies seem to think that they can run their kind of customer support over Twitter, or you're right, like on a chatbot. But those things don't work for everyone. Those things don't work for a lot of people. I had an issue with a big bank recently about a credit card that I applied for. I went on and I tried to use the chatbot. It's completely useless. Like, they just don't help at all. I think these companies forget that a lot of their customers are perhaps older, and, you know, they don't have Twitter. I mean, you know, we're kind of journalists. We kind of live in the world of social media. Most people don't. Some people just like to speak to someone on the phone, which is absolutely fine. And I think companies are using this as a kind of cost-cutting exercise, because obviously it's cheaper for for companies to, you know, have some answering tweets than to have people kind of answering the phone all day. But it's not right. I think they kind of owe it to their customers to do better, really. Unfortunately, with companies like energy companies, it seems like, obviously British Gas is a particularly bad example, but in a lot of ways they're all as bad as each other. So people aren't even going to vote with their feet, because it's what you go from one to the other. And like, is their customer service better? Probably not. To be honest, I think it's up to the regulators, up to Ofgem, to make them sort it out, really, because it's completely unacceptable.
Who else did badly on this, Helen, on the Money Mail's Wooden Spoon Award?
So British Gas took a huge chunk of the votes. They got just under a third. Second place was John Lewis, which is really interesting, because they were they've got a reputation as a bit of a kind of customer service star.
We're going to talk about Customer Service Institute's award thing research later. And John Lewis actually came out top in that one for customer service. I don't, like, what's going on?
Yeah, it's a bit bizarre, isn't it? I think there's kind of two issues here. So I think the thing that's annoyed Money Mail readers is there was this big issue earlier in the year with people who had John Lewis credit cards. They changed their credit card provider, and a lot of people were forced to reapply for a credit card they already had, which is obviously annoying. And a lot of people also got their credit limits absolutely slashed for apparently no reason. Their circumstances hadn't changed. John Lewis had just switched to a different credit card company, and it kind of all hell broke loose. So I think that's probably what's behind this poor performance in the Wooden Spoon Awards. Why I think they've done so well in this other kind of survey is perhaps because of the sort of legacy good customer service of John Lewis. You know, a lot of people still think of them as a company that has very good customer service because of things like giving out free coffees and, you know, the kind of price promise that they used to have. They'd sort of match price elsewhere, which I think I'm right in saying they don't do anymore. But I think perhaps they're still kind of trading on that old reputation, and maybe some of their customers haven't realized that things have maybe changed a bit at John Lewis. You know, they're still in that old mindset of, oh, you know, yeah, they give out free coffees, I get a free newspaper there, and maybe haven't kind of realized what else is going on. You know, it takes a while for companies' reputation to change, I think, and maybe that's a bit of a legacy vote. I'd be interested in seeing whether they turn up on that again next year.
Interesting stuff. Tanya?
Someone in my family had a John Lewis credit card. Absolutely outraged, contacted me obviously to ask what's going on here. She was so upset that she'd and offended that she was asked to reapply for a credit card that she'd held and paid off religiously for years. That she left them. She said, I don't want to know, I'm not going to reapply, where else can I go? So I redirected her to the M&S credit card. So now, instead of the rewards she got from John Lewis, she gets a sort of similar level, if not better, rewards from using an M&S credit card. So it had a happy ending. But some of the people that got turned down had a similar history to her. And I wonder whether she would even have been accepted. Obviously, we'll never know. But yeah, it definitely left a bad taste in her mouth, having been a John Lewis customer for many, many years and been perfectly happy. It's difficult to describe, but she took it as an insult, frankly.
Yeah, and that's the thing about a company that it does do very well. It's got a bit of a cuddly view. And when they do something bad, it's almost even worse because you just don't expect it. Regulator Ofcom this week, Helen, also released their best and worst landline, broadband and pay TV providers for customer complaints. The winners and the losers on this one.
Sure. So Ofcom have looked at providers of broadband, TV and phone services, and they've done a kind of name and shame of the ones that have had the most complaints. Number one was Shell Energy, which does provide broadband and landline services as well as being an energy company. They got the most complaints for both broadband and landline services. So this is between July and September this year. And I think that this kind of comes at a time when broadband bills are going up. From March, the average person is going to face increases up to £95 a year. So I think, again, it's like the energy companies. People are annoyed that they're paying more and they're not getting the service that they expect. Other companies that performed pretty badly, BT Mobile was the company that had the most complaints about mobile phones, and Virgin Media had the highest number of complaints about pay TV, although there is only kind of a handful of pay TV companies. So the reasons they complained, faulty service, 38%, this is across all of the companies, poor complaints handling, 31%, and billing was 18% of complaints. Ofcom gave Shell a bit of kind of rap on the knuckles, actually. It seems like they're particularly concerned about this. They said they're monitoring their performance closely, and they urge it to get a grip on identifying and addressing the root causes of these issues. So, yeah, sounds like there's some quite unhappy Shell Energy customers out there. Actually, they were way out in front. So per 100,000 customers, Shell Energy had 27 complaints. This is on broadband. The second most complaints was TalkTalk, which was 18 out of 100,000. So it seems like there really is something maybe going a bit wrong over at Shell. Again, a company that has made massive profits from the energy crisis.
Well, let's talk about some better news here. As I mentioned there, John Lewis coming out in the top 10 of the UK Customer Service Institute's latest figures, looking at, obviously, customer service. An interesting one, as we've mentioned there, because people were not very happy with John Lewis. But also another interesting one in the top 10 is strike hit Amazon.
Yeah, it's wild, isn't it? So actually number one in that survey was First Direct, the bank, but closely followed by John Lewis in second place. Amazon up there, number 10. So it was in the kind of bottom of that top tranche, but quite surprising. I don't know if it's maybe because people who have Prime, it is a good service. Okay, there's issues around kind of Amazon sort of ethically and sort of treading down on small businesses, but I have Prime and it is good. Things do normally arrive on time. And if you look at issues that people are having with delivery companies, so we had an article on This Is Money this week about Evri, formerly known as Hermes. When people are getting deliveries from retailers who use third-party companies like that, they're having terrible issues. So I think maybe when people order Amazon, at least they know that they're going to get what they ordered and probably in good time, which shouldn't really be something that wins you a place in the top 10 customer service companies. But I think at the minute, it's enough to get you in.
So good to their customers, just not amazing to their staff, maybe. Finally, how do you spot a bargain at charity stores and car boot sales and then sell them on for a profit? Helen, talking of our good friend Lee Boyce, this is all about his series, his Never Go Broke. He's written a book about it, by the way. He can pay me some of the royalties later for advertising it for him. But this is a good one because I do enjoy going to charity stores. Car boot sales, not so much, just because I don't know where they are. But then how do you sell it on for a profit? I've never done that.
Yeah, so this is something that Lee really likes to talk about. You're right, Lee can pay us our cut of his profits later. But it's about reselling things, especially finding things that are a bit unloved. So going to charity shops, boot sales, and sort of digging for hidden treasure, which is fun in and of itself. I love a charity shop, love finding a bargain. But what Lee's talking about here is buying those things and then flipping them on, selling them online for a profit. So he's got a few kind of tips here which are quite useful. So going to car boot sales, he's advocating something called the locust approach. Get there early, buzz around quickly, get the pick of the best items, and he says to haggle quite hard with sellers. So go up to them and say, I'm offering hard cash for this straight away, you're not going to get a better deal than this all day. Really go in hard and get those bargains early. He also advises when you arrive at a car boot sale, take a power walk away from the stores by the entrance towards the back and work backwards. So then you're avoiding all of the other locusts buzzing around the car boot sale. The kind of items he suggests buying, and I thought this was a bit surprising. So CDs, DVDs and video games apparently do quite well when you're reselling online. You might not think that's the kind of thing that people would necessarily buy anymore. But what Lee's saying is, you can use, so there's apps and websites. One of them that you might have heard of is Music Magpie. There's also Zephyr and We Buy Books for Books. And they basically, they buy these items based on their barcodes. So you scan their barcodes and they'll give you a kind of flat price. So you've got all this stuff and we'll give you X amount for it. I actually don't know what these companies do with those things, perhaps kind of recycle them or something, I think. I don't think they're kind of selling them on to customers, but there's some kind of value in these, and they'll kind of give you a price for a job lot. And you know, a car boot sale, you might pay like 10p for a CD, but by selling on a job lot to one of these websites, apparently you can make quite a tidy profit. So yeah, seems like it's good fun to go and have a dig around a car boot sale or a charity shop, can make you a bit of money. And yeah, sounds quite a nice idea. He's kind of inspired me to maybe see where my local car boot sale is.
All right then, that's it. You can keep up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. And if you have any comments or questions for the team or anything you'd like them to look into, Helen?
You can email us on editor@thisismoney.co.uk, tweet us @thisismoney, or come to thisismoney.co.uk/podcast to join the debate in the reader comments.
Marvellous. And if you like our podcast, why not rate us wherever you found us? It helps other people find us too.
Market updates and conversations around the financial world don't have to be boring. The Digest and Invest podcast by eToro is a great way to tune into what's happening in a fun and easily digestible format. Discover the Digest and Invest podcast at eToro.com/academy/podcasts.